The views and opinions expressed in the Humanizing the Headset podcast are those of the authors, guests, and hosts of the podcast, and do not necessarily reflect the opinion or position of Humanizing the Headset as a whole. This podcast may contain adult language and adult content. Hello, welcome back again.
Welcome back to Humanizing the Headset.
Hello, hello.
We are recording. What episode are we on? I really need to keep track of these.
15.
15.
Oh, I was going to say 12. Holy shnike.
Yeah.
A few episodes ago.
So, anyway, today we have a special guest for everybody, Donna Brown. Hi, Donna.
Good morning. Hi, Donna.
I'm terrible at introductions, so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself so everybody knows why we have you here?
Sure. I worked at the Tallahassee Police Department, Tallahassee, Florida, which is Florida's capital city, for 26 years, 3 months and 5 days to be exact. Had the normal assignments like everybody else. When I did start, and I'm going to date myself, which was 1979, I was one of only five women. So new to the department, but also a very new oddity to the community. But I was a field training officer. I worked in our department's training unit. I got promoted, was a field training sergeant, and moved into our CID, where I spent my last 15 years. In my last 10 years, I supervised our homicide unit.
Nice.
So for those that don't know, CID is?
Criminal Investigation Division.
I knew what it was because we
have
CID, but I ran into some agencies. I'm like, well, I have to get you up to CID. And they're like, what?
Who's that?
Right. Literally, I was going to ask because we don't have that. We just have an investigations department.
Right.
It's a CIB Bureau or Investigative Division. You're right. And I apologize for that.
It's what you did for a living. I wanted to bring it up because I thought it was interesting. Where I used to live, their police department, because I worked for an IT company and we did a lot of the work at the PD. Theirs was called a detective bureau. That's what they call it.
Right.
I know there are some that call it Bureau of Detectives and all that stuff. So just for those that don't know, we acronym you. But
anyway. We do. And I try to be very good about that. So thank you for catching that.
Oh, please.
But I woke up one morning and I went, ooh, I'm done. And it's kind of a funny story. I started asking other people that had retired before me and, you know, friends. And I'm like, how do you know when it's time to go? And they're like, you'll know. And I'm like, well, that's not helpful. And I swear to God, one morning the alarm went off and I'm sitting on the side of the bed and it was like, I'm done. Seriously, I'm done. And at that point, it was merely a matter of picking my date. And I did that and have not looked back at all.
When you did that, and you know, we'll get into some of your other ventures here in a little bit, but when you did that, when you started asking everybody the question, how soon before your time that you decided were you asking that question? Do you remember?
Probably a good year, because at 25 years I could go at full benefit. So 24 and a half ish, maybe I started asking. And like I said, a lot of people I'd worked with had gone. And I had already kind of started preparing for that, which I totally suggest for anybody, even you guys, don't just do it without a plan. So like I said, once I made that decision, it was kind of like I lost like 100 pounds. It was really just a huge relief. And I said, pick my date.
Yeah, I saw that. So, admittedly, I'll be the person to admit, I started reading book two, And of course, I tried to do it at work, so that did not help me a lot. But I did make it a few chapters in, and of course, I got to, because you're at the beginning, you tell your story. And I thought that was pretty interesting how you said that it just kind of all goes away. And this is something I've been talking about, and I wanted to bring it up in our podcast with how your job, or how a lot of, especially police and fire, their job is all they know. And then when they're done, they don't know what to do with themselves.
Right.
It defines who they are. And then when they're done, they don't know who they are anymore. I thought that was pretty interesting that you said that.
Did you ever feel that way?
Actually, yes. It kind of crept up on me and I didn't really realize it. With our department, like I said, I spent 10 years supervising the homicide unit. It got to the point that our public information office and the chief and that were like, look, you just start doing all of the media interviews because you know what you want released or don't want released, those kinds of things. So I did. And I really didn't realize it, but like I'd be in the grocery store and somebody come up to me and go, oh, you're Sergeant Donna Brown. I saw you on the news. And I slowly became Sergeant Donna Brown, homicide sergeant. And I really didn't realize it till after I'd retired that I had really lost who I was. And then it was a matter of rediscovering that's what I did for a living. That's really not who I am. And it was a process.
Yeah,
I bet.
Yeah.
And that's so crazy to think about that you almost became like a TV character to yourself.
It wasn't, I mean, and I'll be honest with you, the way we were set up back then, and I went through several lieutenants and captains and that, and some had their different roles. I mean, there were times when I was required to respond to every single death investigation, even though I had detectives there, you know, so I'd go 30 some odd days without a day off, or, you know, 36 hours without any sleep, and you know, and it's just, and honestly, to do that kind of work, you really have to give 110%. And I said, I really didn't realize any of that, that it just kind of happened until it was done. And then I look back and I'm like, wow.
No. But you don't know it when it's normal to you. That's
right.
That's how you do it. So when people listen to this and talk to people like yourself, they don't think twice about it. They probably go, holy shit, I can't believe you did that. You know, that's crazy. Why are you doing that? And you're like, what?
That was my job. I mean, I didn't, right. And now, I mean, of course, we've grown even more. My old agency is about 480 sworn.
Okay.
Which, of course, they're severely understaffed like everybody else. I think last I talked to someone, they've got 50 some odd vacancies, but
Wow. Now
they've divided the city into quadrants. They have more than one. Now it's violent crime. So it's not just because we had one homicide unit and I had six detectives and we handled the entire city.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So with, you know, everybody rotating call every 6th week. And so things are a lot better in that respect for the supervisors and for the investigators.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. We have a big shortage right now because of COVID. Because they're not taking anyone in the academy right now. I think they're restarting in September.
Wow.
So we've been pulling people from CID and from other divisions as well to work the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, we had several go through the academy during COVID. It wasn't an issue.
Really?
What academy are you sending people to?
Springfield?
That's a great question.
That is a great question.
I'm not kidding. We have like seven.
Which academy are we sending them to? Academy of Arts and Sciences, maybe? I don't know.
Like the wrong academy. One.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah, no, we definitely had 6 or 7 go through. I don't know if it was the state or Springfield or the state or the, what's the other one? NIU has one? Someone, what university? Oh,
I'm not sure. That's what I was told. Maybe I was misinformed. I don't know. But we are incredibly short because we haven't been able to send them for whatever reason.
Right. And we just graduated a class out at our academy. And so Florida, it's 25 weeks. So, you know, it started, I would assume, you know, right at the beginning of the new year. So,
wow.
I guess COVID really didn't impact it that much.
So I'm going to add, well, it's Florida. Let's be honest. It's Florida.
Exactly. I don't think COVID impacted Florida though.
Florida's like, what's the pandemic?
Wow. Yeah.
Right.
Sorry. I don't even think we need to go down that road.
Yeah.
No judgment.
That would be a non-recorded conversation.
Right. Yeah. Anyway.
It's interesting, Donna, that you said, you literally just said we had this many people go through the academy, et cetera. So are you still involved at work?
No, I'm not. Yeah. And I will always be attached to the agency for sure. I still have people that are good friends that still work there, have moved up the chain of command, which is nice to see. One of my rookies recently, well, about 5 years ago, retired as a deputy chief, which really dated myself. But
wow, that had to feel crazy.
Right. And it was a female, one of my first female recruits.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I was very, very proud of her. They have retirement functions every now and then. I try to go to as many retirement ceremonies as I can, sometimes promotional ceremonies. So I do stay involved a little bit. And our new chief, I've known him since he got hired. So I say we.
Oh, hey. And you should.
Yeah, absolutely. You've dedicated your entire life to that organization,
right?
You own it.
I graduated from Florida State in August and I was hired in October. It's the only full-time job I ever had.
Wow.
I was hired at 21. I grew up there. So, I mean, it will always be home.
Sure.
No matter what. Yeah.
What kind of pioneer? I don't want to throw words around like, you're a pioneer and you paved the way, you know.
Fossil.
Right. Oh my God.
Definitely not. You're
quite the fossil, Donna. like you had mentioned earlier and you talked about in your book about being one of only a few, and it was an anomaly back then that there was a female in one of those roles. So you're part of that department, you know, like, and not just because you're a cop, but you have that extra layer of being a lady that made it all the way through, stuck it out pretty damn successfully, I will say.
Thank you.
Because I think a lot of people, I think you see it more with women, they'll probably be more likely to, obviously they're gonna be the ones to have the babies, and they'll be more likely to switch than the male role will. You know, the guys are probably gonna stay in it longer maybe than women are. So for you to stay in it that long and retire and be that successful is impressive. You know, it really is. So I can see why you're still part of that agency. And they probably see you as the same way.
Yeah. So. Well, I said when I was hired, I was only one of five women. And now I think the department is maybe 12, 14% female, which is still, I think, low. But I think that in putting that into perspective with around the country, that's probably not bad.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a role I think that a lot of women probably even consider. You know, I think you have to have a certain mindset as a person in general.
Oh, absolutely.
In this field, no matter what role it is, whether you're a dispatcher, whether you're a police officer, whether you're a firefighter, you have to have a certain mentality.
And especially now.
That down. Yes. Right, right. Pare that down. And yeah, your percentage is probably the right percentage to be where it needs to be, I would think. So
we have a couple of female officers. And we kind of joke, which it's not even really a joke, but they are far more intimidating than most of the men that we have on our department. And I always tell people, like, yeah, because they had to build that part of their persona up a little bit more than the men would have to.
Yeah. I can see that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, I'm not a big person, 5'4". And as men started getting used to us, and started going on calls with us, I had several on my shift come up to me and go, you know, I'd really rather answer calls with you because I get into a lot less fights. And it's, you know, you have to develop that power of conversation,
right?
You know, to be able to communicate, because I obviously knew my physical limitations and I could talk my way out of a lot of things, at least until I got help,
right?
Or backup got there. So that was kind of a running joke. I'll go answer a call with her. I'll back her up.
Right. Yeah.
It's funny. I don't know if he listens to our podcast, but we had a deputy retire several years ago, and he'd been on the road for a long time, and kind of grizzled, you know, one of those guys, and super nice guy. But I can remember him being, he was a shorter guy. He's probably like 5'5", I'd say, skinny. And one night him and his partner, who was like 6'3", 6'4", younger, big guy, had an intoxicated guy, and they gave him a ride to a hotel. And then they got there, and the guy decided all of a sudden he wanted to square off. And he said, he looked at his partner, the big guy, and then he looked at him, and he was like, okay, well, I'm gonna go after him. He's like, don't do it. And then next thing you hear on the radio, one tased. That's it. He's like, he used to like to fight and scrap, you know, the little guy, but he's like, I don't do it anymore. They square off, you get tased, that's it, we're done.
Hey.
Can't do it.
Yeah.
And he would do it all quiet. He just like, one tase. Okay. All right.
All casual about it.
Yeah.
You shouldn't celebrate when somebody gets tased, but I hate to say it, I kind of do.
Problem resolved.
Yeah.
We are true. Two.
True, true, true.
So Donna has written a couple of books here called Behind and Yes. Beyond the Badge. She has volume one and volume two. Tell us a little bit about your books, Donna. Why'd you write these?
I get asked that obviously all the time. And honestly, they were born out of anger.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Volume one, I started writing in 2016. And that was not long after Michael Brown Ferguson situation. And I think the climate in this country was very similar to what it is now. It was very anti-law enforcement, anti-cop. And that's all I kept seeing on the media, social media, was just everything negative. And I got angry. And I'm like, you know, God, there's over 800,000 cops in this country, and the vast majority are just not only good cops, they're good people.
People, yeah.
And that was the whole thing. I started talking to people and all different age groups. You know, I really never stopped to think that there's a person behind the badge. I just see a cop, or I see a firefighter, and they just don't associate that. They see the badge. So I'm like, what can I do? Because my one of my goals was to start humanizing the badge. So I came up with this. I said, I want to tell individual stories about people who've either done the job or are currently doing the job. And not just, oh, you know, Donna worked 26 years and she had these jobs. But I started asking, you know, what's your favorite part, your most difficult part? Some talk about PTSD, some... And one big question I asked was career defining moments. And when I started pitching this, and in the first book, everybody was retired, because I really didn't know, you know, if agencies would really allow participation a lot. So everybody in the first book is retired. And I started out sending them all questionnaires, and the responses I got in writing were way more than I ever could have hoped for. And all of them told me just how therapeutic or healing it was actually to write down their thoughts. Mm-hmm. Because I told them, I said, this is your story. I'm merely the vessel to tell it. So, but then I got to think, I said, you know, I could never have done my job without firefighters, without EMS, without dispatchers, without forensics, which is a group I think is totally forgotten. And then we're an agency that I'm going to say blessed. We have a full-time victim advocate unit. And nice. They were just an integral part of everything, especially we did in homicide. So in the book, there's a dispatcher, a firefighter. I will say primarily it's focused on law enforcement, but I had to include everybody. And then I also included a woman whose husband was killed in the line of duty out in California. And I thought that was a perspective that those outside the first responder world really needed to hear. So I put it out there, and really not knowing, I'd never written a book. The response I got back was phenomenal. It opened up so many doors for me, speaking engagements, those types of things. I had police explorers come up to me and say, thank you for writing this. I actually have some true insight as to what I can expect if I choose to do this job. I had dispatchers, police officers, firefighters, thank you for including us and letting us educate people about what we do, how we do it, why we do it, how it affects us. And like I said, it opens so many doors for me, and I really like the public speaking because I can do just that. And so people are like, well, are you going to do volume two? Really wanted it. So I did. And honestly, I think volume two is even deeper than volume one. I think I'm a better writer from the experience and stuff, but you know, like the two dispatchers I chose for volume one and volume two are just phenomenal people. The things they've done and continue to do, you know, and I'm so glad that a lot of states are starting to classify you guys as first responders. We still have a long ways to go. You mm-hmm. truly are the first responders. But another group that, well, and you guys are often included, I like this too, in the mental health push that's going on now. It's not just law enforcement and fire. Now we've included dispatch, which I keep pushing as well. But when I mentioned forensics, people look at me like, well, they're not first responders. And I'm like, no, but they're responders. And any crime scene, but let's take a mass casualty, you know, and I talked to somebody who did Pulse in Orlando. Okay, you've got 49 deceased people.
Oh, gosh.
You know, you've got cell phones going off, mm-hmm. you know, and they're thinking, you know, those are family members calling these people, you know, so that's all in the back of their head. But, you know, your forensics people, they see it. They have to step over it. They have to photograph it. They have to measure it. They have to collect it. They have to testify about it. And I think that group of people are just too excluded. And I'm really trying to start pushing that they be included. We started including everybody when we had debriefings. Everyone who responded, but that included our dispatchers, our forensics people, our victim advocates and stuff. So I'm also, awesome. That's all part of, for me, humanizing the badge. And I know you guys may wear a badge. I'm not sure with your if you have uniforms or such, but ours do. Whether it's whether it's a polo with an embroidered badge or right, whatever, yeah. there's something there. And our forensics people have that too. So, I said, that's my goal is to humanize the badge. And when my talks with people, they really just don't have a clue what any of these jobs do. And I've talked with some, mostly police officers, and they're like, I don't talk about this stuff because people don't understand. And I think we're at a point, if you don't talk about it now, they can't understand. And right. I think we're at that point. These conversations have to be had. And like I said, not just for law enforcement, but for everybody, because it's all part of the cog. Right. Not to ramble, but I always give people at all of my talks, I'm like, what do you think happens when you call 911? And they all go, well, you know, simple answer, I call and somebody comes. That's true. But I'm like, okay, first off, somebody has to answer the phone. Some agency have call takers, some that's a separate position. They're the ones who ask you all those stupid questions. You know, where do you live?
Thing to do.
Where are you at, or where do you live? Or right. I said, okay, then there's someone has to dispatch that. And I said, let's say in this instance it's a police officer. Okay, so the officer gets there, and in a matter of seconds or minutes, they have to make a decision. All right, crap. I need fire, please. I need EMS, please. I need forensics, please. I need a supervisor, please. I need, you know, and I literally watch people's eyes widen and jaws drop. They don't have a clue how this whole process works. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of questions about, I don't understand why they ask me all those stupid questions. And that's a whole conversation we have just about what you guys do.
Right.
And that's in volume two. Will Blanton is the dispatcher in the book. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, please go into your work schedule, because it's very similar to that of law enforcement. You miss holidays, you miss, you know, all of that. And again, people are like, well, I just had no idea.
Yeah. People that we hire have no idea. Yeah. Even though we tell them.
Right.
We lost both of them.
I'm here.
Close. Yeah, you're there. You and I are here. Haley and Brendan
disappeared.
Must have had a lightning strike. They paused. I'll send them a message and let them know they froze up so they can rejoin. But I think it's interesting. So you did say that in the second book, and I was going to say that now this stage is mine. They're gone. My head, when you talked about that as to how many different things pop up or how many things have to happen in order for a call to get dispatched.
Right. And
my brain went, okay, here's you, right? And I had an infographic idea in my head. Here's you. This is the officer that's on scene, or this is your incident. But then I had this like pyramid from below with like, oh, did you call? Do you need public works? Is public works needed? Is the utility company needed? Oh, we have a wire down. All of those things. And I had this idea as you were talking a second ago that I think it would be pretty cool, because sometimes you have we go to events, hold events. Brendan said internet crash, stand by. Oh. the dog must have got tired from running. We hold these events and it's like educational, right? So there's always like a job fair type of thing or a business fair. We've had them at our at a mall where we take out the 911 phone so they can kind of see what happens, you know, that type of thing. And I think it would be interesting to have people sit down and do the test, right? So some people have the critical test, or where you get to pick, okay, I have this call and I got to type this much, but I have to pick these things to understand, at least from a dispatch side, these are all of the things that have to happen.
Right.
You know, and you have to make these decisions in seconds, all while listening to what they're saying and trying to decipher it and use the useful information and weed through it. You know,
because we're not just,
I know some places document everything that is said. I know at our agency, we're allowed to summarize and put it in a call rather than just type everything they're doing, you know.
Right.
So I had this idea, I actually wrote it down because I think that would be an amazing idea to have people sit at a computer and just do the little test and get a sense of what's happening. Now put yourself in a police officer's shoes and they're on scene and they have all this stuff going on. They have people that are hysterical because somebody was injured. You know, they're having to talk on the radio to the people asking them questions about where they're at, and other people coming in, you know, they don't, and that's just the functionality of it. That's not
right
what they're seeing, you know? So I like that you wrote this. I think it's very good for people to understand the human aspect of it and why at least from a police standpoint, and even firefighter and stuff. I say that as far as firefighter, because firefighters in EMS, they deal with traumatic events just like everybody else. There's no doubt
right.
about it.
Right.
But the difference is, I don't know, is there ever a time that people hate firefighters? I don't think there's ever a time they hate firefighters. They're always heroes, and they really are. So that I'm not diminishing that at all. But, you know, cops have the unenviable task of arresting people and sometimes having to shoot at people. And, you know, firefighters save people, you know, and that right. they always help. And the public sees it that way. And like you said, right now, even with the notice and stuff, that was, there's this, the wave. I remember somebody in roll call said, this is how it goes. It's like a sine wave, okay? Here, we're for these couple years, we're at top. Everybody loves everybody. And then something happens, and now we're at the bottom of the sine wave, and then we come back to where right. people understand it. I think that's pretty interesting.
Well, and people ask me about the defunding or, you know, and all of that. And I think as a profession, we have evolved to where we are because law enforcement has become, and this is my opinion, I hate to say it, law enforcement has become the dumping ground.
Yeah.
Is, you know, we get called to the mental health calls, we get called to, you know, domestics, we get called, I mean, to everything. We still have officers, I talk to them. We still have officers who get dispatched to someone's home in the morning because mom can't get her 16-year-old kid to go to school or 15-year-old kid to go to school.
And when I tell kid to go to school.
Right. And when I tell people these stories, they're like, you're kidding. And I'm like, no. I said, but you know, we still have people who call dispatch because their cable's out. I mean, especially here in hurricane
country. Or the internet's out, like what we just had.
Yeah. No, trust me, the calls they get when we have a hurricane, it's my cable's out. How long before? I mean, just ridiculous. But, and I think that's, people are starting to realize that. And I think most in law enforcement do understand that. And they're looking for, yes, let's create a mental health unit, which is starting to happen more and more. You know, making officers a priority and their mental health and that a priority. So when it comes to defunding, I almost like to say, you know, how about maybe some reallocation, you know, of funds. But the bottom line, you can't do any of this without training, and training costs money. You know, as you guys know, whether it's training for dispatch, training for fire, training for law enforcement, it's not cheap, especially if you want to have good quality training or bring somebody from the outside or whatever. So I think some very good things can come out of where we're at. It's just a matter of, let's see, you know, what happens.
I think,
and I don't know what you guys were talking about while we were trying to get you reconnected.
So much shit about you guys.
But, yeah, right? Sorry, my internet suddenly went out.
You should have seen the sergeant came out. Like, what are these clowns doing?
I just think it's funny that everyone's response to we don't like how police are doing to be doing things better is to give them less money, you know. And I think it's ridiculous. I was talking to somebody the other day, and I'm like, you know, people need police more than they will ever realize. And the case in point that you were just talking about, like, people call us because they can't go next door and tell their neighbor to turn their music down. You know,
yep.
Like, come on.
Yep.
So, yeah. Well, I'd like to know what your thoughts are on, there's a program out of Seattle, I want to say, called Cahoots. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No.
They're like a mental health unit that will go out to non-emergency calls where it's like a mental health issue, as opposed to sending an officer. I'm kind of for that. I think it's a good idea. Obviously, I think that there's situations where an officer will have to respond.
Right.
But I think it's a good addition to that.
Well, it's like any new program, you know, and as an example, I don't know if you're familiar with, it's an HBO documentary that actually won an Emmy. It's called Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops. And they modeled their mental health unit after that. And they're sworn officers, but they're always in plain clothes. And it took a while to convince all the other officers and such to get on board with this, but they respond to all mental health calls. And it freed up officers, obviously, to handle other types of situations, but they forged incredible relationships with, you know, the hospitals, social workers, all of those things. And they check up on these people. All they really need is an ID card. We can help them get that. Or it's well worth the watch. And I've actually become pretty good friends with Ernie via social media, and that we connected. And he's agreed to be in volume 3 if I finally get to writing it. But
nice.
So yes, and Tallahassee has just started a unit. It's not a 24-hour unit yet. But it has, I believe, a firefighter who's EMS, a law enforcement officer, and someone from social services. I haven't really heard how that's gone so far. It's only been maybe a month or so.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm all for things like that.
Yeah.
You got to try them, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I think there's promise there.
I think
the key is to try it just to see, mm-hmm. you know, what can happen, and just instead of saying, no, I don't like the idea, it's not going to work, you know.
Right, exactly. There's obviously an issue. There's some kind of issue. I can't really pinpoint what the issue is that's going on today with the relationship between law enforcement and the public.
Right.
So I think you use the term reallocating things. I think that's a good way to describe it, reallocating. Whether that be, you know, funds or resources a good place to start, and just see, you know, would this work better if we did it this way?
Right.
Well, and actually it was a guy I used to work with. He petitioned, he saw it was a huge problem, and it is probably everywhere, obviously, somehow noting on a driver's license that the person is deaf or has some other issue. You know, you've got an officer who's yelling commands at somebody. Well, they're deaf, mm-hmm. you know, and you can see how that can go downhill very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I just saw somewhere on social media, I think it was yesterday or the day before, an officer who gets called about this kid who's out on the streets, and he's trying to communicate and realizes this kid has nonverbal autism. So he's down on his knees, and he hands the kid paper and a pencil. The kid can write, so he gets the kid to communicate that way, and they end up getting the kid back to where he was supposed to be.
Right.
Awesome. And, you know, so, you know, if do we need more training on those types of things? Do we, you know, like I said, I'm not in the field anymore, but I mean, there's always things the profession can do better. Any profession can do better.
Absolutely. Well, and the world is very rapidly changing,
right?
Especially when it comes to awareness about mental health and other things like autism that might prevent someone from communicating normally.
Right.
Or I guess communicating the way most people communicate, so.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one thing with the books too, is I've had spouse, as a matter of fact, Ernie, he doesn't mind me telling this story. Ernie read the books, and volume 2, he and his wife read it together. And he told me, he said, they have a great relationship, great communications. So they thought, when she finished reading the book, she's like, I thought I knew what you did for a living.
Oh, wow.
And he's the type, he would come home and they would actually talk about his day, where a lot of people don't do that. Mm-hmm. So I think it was reading thoughts of other officers, and because some of those stories are pretty emotional, the impact it had, you know, certain situations and that on, and I think that just kind of, you know, rung a bell for her. And he said now their communication skills have even gotten better. So I just, when I hear stories like that, I'm like, you know, If I never sell another copy of the books, between people telling me it was therapeutic to write their thoughts down, to a spouse saying that, you know, one person at a time.
And that story so often goes the other way.
Right.
Where the communication becomes worse, and the partners aren't communicating with each other at all because they don't want to talk about their day, and then divorce or depression or whatever. So it's wonderful that that was a positive experience for them to do that together.
There's even like with my husband and I, like he stopped asking me or stopped telling me about his days, you know, how his day is going, because he felt that his stressors were not equal to mine, you know. And I would tell him, I'm like, you know, stress is relative. Every job has its stress.
Right.
And it's important to validate that. Like, just because I took a homicide call today and you had an angry caller, it's justified. Your emotional reaction and your response to that is justified, just as mine and vice versa, you know. So don't think that the rough day that you have, you shouldn't talk to me about it because, you know, you don't think it's worthy because I may have had a day that's different than yours.
Right.
You know, it's still relative. It's still justified. So you should still talk about it, you know.
I've had that before too, because that's always, people don't want to tell us about the tough time they're having because they're like, well, it doesn't compare. And I'm like,
right.
And everyone's allowed to have a tough time at any point in time. Like, it doesn't matter who you are or what you do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think it's important, though, not to, I mean, when it comes to that, there are people that'll go, oh, you had a rough day? Let me tell you about this. You can't do that. Because, you know, we might do it with one another. Oh, yeah? Well, take this.
I can top that.
You don't one-up people on your trauma.
Right. That's part of it. But as long as, you know, if it's a serious conversation, they have to know that the question is, were you stressed? Yeah. Did it bother you a lot? Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about it.
Right.
That's the whole point. Like, I tell Tina all the time, Tina's my wife. I tell her all the time, we'll talk about things and I'll have logical answers for her. And she's like, oh, you're always so calm about it and all this. You give me good advice. I go, that's because I'm not in the middle of it. It's not emotional for me. I'm not stressed out about it. So it's very easy for me to give you a outside perspective as to how I'm hearing this and how I'm doing it, because I'm not in the middle of it. You're emotional about it because you're in the middle of the stress. I'm not. And it would be vice versa. You know, it would be very easy for her to tell me something. Well, what about this or whatever? And I'll go, oh, okay. That makes sense. You know, because you're just not in the middle of it.
And that's another big thing for me. It's another one of the byproducts of the books. And when I do the public speaking engagements, is the mental health aspect. And I had one person tell me, cops can't get PTSD. And I'm like,
that is insane. Who let those words come out of their mouth?
Well, and I'm like, okay. I said, why do you believe that? Well, you're not in the military and you didn't go fight a war. And I mean, I let them, and I'm like, okay. So then we get into the conversation about cumulative PTSD, which is most for first responders, not always. Right. There are specific incidents that can set it off, but for most it's cumulative, whether it's fire, dispatch, EMS, police, whatever. If you do it long enough, you're going to have that. And when we get into that kind of, and I'm not a mental health professional, obviously, but when I have those conversations with people, again, you can see, crap, I never thought of it in that way. And I'm like, okay, I said, take me individually. In my 10 years in homicide, I supervised 561 death investigations. If you do the math, that's over one a week for 10 years. Like, you can't do this job and not be affected. Period.
Right.
It's somebody tells you it doesn't bother them, it doesn't affect them, blah, blah, blah. Pinocchio.
Yeah.
Not being truthful with themselves or other people.
I would challenge that person and ask them the question of, you know, have you ever met somebody that was sexually abused as a child, or was a victim of domestic violence for a number of years? And now they do this whenever something happens, you know, they flinch. What do you think that is? That's stress. It's post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. So they have it, but they didn't go fight in a war. They weren't in the military. So what do you call that? You know, hello, you have no idea. And then even if it wasn't cumulative, even if you take a percentage of, how do you want to say it? Not an active shooter, but you know, you go out on a call and it's an immediate stress where somebody is fighting or pointing a gun or whatever. How is that not considered war? I mean,
well, exactly. But there's I know I don't have all the facts exact, but there was an officer who responded to Pulse nightclub in Orlando and diagnosed with PTSD. He went through a whole thing about, you know, they were going to let him go. They were going to not cover it. Then, you know, he lost a job and he got a job. I mean, you know, so the profession is evolving as well. And I'm glad to see that more and more agencies, and again, not just police, but fire and dispatching EMS are recognizing that. And I'm only hoping that it continues to move forward in a positive way. But I said, it's having these conversations, and that's why I try to encourage people in these fields. Like, you know, your first reaction, Kaylee, about who let something like that come out of their mouth. I agree, in the back of my mind, I'm going, really? But I sit there and listen to, you know, why they feel that way. I'm like, okay. And then we have the other side of the conversation. I said, 9 times out of 10, I see a light bulb come on.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And again, that's my goal of one person at a time, one conversation at a time, you know, one person who reads the book, you know, and that's kind of my mantra is my books don't have the power to change minds, but perhaps by offering a different perspective, it can open them. And, you know, you guys need to be having conversations like that with the public. You know, EMS needs to be doing that. It's everybody.
And yeah. Going through this book, this was so interesting to me because, like, there's a lot of books out there that are by first responders, by retired first responders, whether it be police, firefighter. And like, I'm not saying this just to blow smoke up your butt. I've never read one that was like this. This was really interesting to me because this reads like a, I don't know, it's like a yearbook almost, where you have all these photos of people and all of their wonderful accomplishments throughout their careers and their words about, like you were saying, their career defining moments and stuff like that. And it was, you know, if your goal was to humanize the badge, definitely this is like the most humanizing thing I've ever read about first responders, honestly.
Thank you.
I was reading, like you said, I was reading it last night in the second story in the second book. Scott, is that right? I'm sitting there having to work and I get to the end of the story and I'm just like, okay, I need to keep it together right here because I got teary-eyed hearing it. I'm like, okay, this doesn't work for me. And I'm kind of a sap when it comes to that stuff anyway. But I was like, oh, wow, okay. You know, the lady that felt he understood and all those people understood her story, you know.
Right.
I thought that was amazing. I was just like, oh, God, no, don't start bawling here. This is
well, you know, and it really took, and I tell people if they only read one story, his story mm-hmm. needs to be the one they read. And it's not, you know, as you read it, that doesn't happen every single day.
Right.
I mean, that was just an incredible story. He is the most humble guy in the world. He hates to talk about all the awards. But when we sat down, and it took me some convincing to let me tell his story. And like I said, he really, and his wife, when I put together the story, and the agreement was actually with the deputy's wife as well, the deputy that was killed, she, mm-hmm. we got her permission. We sat down with her and she says, but I'd like to read his story before it goes to the publisher and is in the book. So we did that. And Scott's wife read it. And she's like, I thought I understood this. And here she's lived this, you know. But you know, not everybody's kids see what they're. Right. I mean, you know, they see their father shoot and kill a man, a bad guy.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and they're traumatized
from their house.
Less. And yeah. Then, you know, they're so traumatized, you know, that they have to move and they sell the house. They, you know, they hear a siren, they freak out. And you know, I said, that's up here. That doesn't happen every day. But I said, Scott, this really shows the human side of what law enforcement is about.
Of having to do your job. I mean, I think that's the tough part. I wrestle with that when I read it, because I'm thinking, okay, how's the public see this? The public sees the police as on a different level than what they are, right? So I like to talk when I talk to people about presidents, okay? We talk about what this president did or what this president did and what they did wrong and why it's a big deal to people. Well, it's a big deal to people because you hold them to a higher standard because of the position that they are in. And right. We expect them to behave this way. But then the word I just used was expect. And that's what we think should be happening, but we forget that they're still people. They are in a different position and they have a lot more responsibility, just like police officers and firefighters and EMTs and everybody has. Right. And you forget because they've gone through this training. They should be able to deal with this. This is the public's opinion. You know, this is what they do. They should be able to make these decisions in milliseconds to shoot somebody in the leg and stop them from running. And then they save their life. And of course the person will magically drop their gun and be like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. You know, it doesn't work that way. And they're tasked with doing this. And how many times in their life are they going to be tasked with doing that? Probably not many. Like you just said with Scott's story, that's one in a million chances that would happen. And if they were doing it every day, okay, maybe their thought process and emotional responses might be different, but they don't. In a 20-year career, they might have one of those incidences or maybe two of those incidences, depending on where they live. And now, yeah, they trained for it, but they never actually had to do it. So what do you want them to do? You know, they did everything they possibly could based on the training they received, and that's the outcome. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad, but it's reality. They have to make these crazy decisions rapidly, you know.
Right. Well, and that's the issue, right, is that we're expecting so much from our law enforcement personnel, and it seems like every day we're expecting them to do more and more and more and more. And we're not giving them any resources, any help, no funding, but the public keeps demanding that they know that they respond perfectly in every single situation. Mm-hmm. And you look at it and you're like, well, actually no. And again, reallocating, like there's a lot of these situations that maybe law enforcement shouldn't be handling. I don't know why we're sending them to it in the first place.
Correct. Well,
you know, it's funny because as you were saying that, Kayla, I was thinking about what we mentioned earlier. People will call in because, or Brendan said, you can't go over to your neighbor and ask them to turn their music down. So you call a police officer to do that. But the reality is in a lot of cases you have to, because the way people one another, you go over there, you don't know what those people are going to do. And that's,
well, it becomes a liability because now, again, because law enforcement, there's so much expected of them and they're held accountable for so many things that really they shouldn't be held accountable for.
Right.
I don't know about where you guys live, and I have this discussion with people as well. Here in Tallahassee, the billboards at almost every major intersection and the commercials on the evening news are what? Personal injury attorneys.
Mm. Yes.
Seriously.
Yeah.
So when I bring this up and I talk about, you know, when you see police officers go into a school and have to deal with a 7 or 8 year old. And I'm like, okay, that didn't happen when I was in school. Teachers and administrators dealt with it. Okay.
Right.
But now if the teacher lays hands on a kid, the parents are going to get upset. The parents are going to sue. The administrators don't want to do it either. So guess what? Let's call the cops. And that's my whole point. Yes, you are correct, Kaylee, is cops have become the dumping ground.
Yes.
For everything.
I was just going to say they've become.
And part of it is society has themselves have created that.
Right.
Hence, you touch my kid, I'm going to sue you.
Yeah.
But if you don't do anything, I'm also going to sue you for failing to respond.
Right. So how did we get to that point?
In not,
as,
in
a, as a society, we need to look at that.
Nobody wants the accountability. No. They want somebody else to take care of it for them so that they don't have, they can wash their hands of it and not be held responsible for any of it.
Right.
They become the catch-all for every situation that people don't want to deal with.
That is correct.
We don't have like our animal control, how animal control works where we live is kind of weird. It's sort of strange. I'm not going to say anything bad about it because these two work for the same agency that has our animal control.
No, but, we don't work with them.
Our officers are sent to animal calls all the time.
Right.
Why? They're not trained to deal with that. They don't know what to do with a sick raccoon.
Right.
Oh, well.
But if we don't go, people get upset and they're like, well, then what am I paying my taxes for? And I'm like, for a cop to come out and shoot a raccoon in your yard? No, that's not what your taxes are going. Like,
right.
Why would you think that that's what we're here for?
Right.
Yeah. And do you know how much ammo is these days? Your taxes aren't paying for that shit.
It's just so strange, like just the weirdest expectation
for that 9mm round, if not more. What are you talking about, lady? So it's very funny that you say that, Haley, because we've actually switched at what I'd say it's the last year, right, B, that we will now go out and shoot a sick raccoon.
Yeah,
but we shouldn't have, like, this is insane, you guys. We shouldn't have to do that. That's not what they went to the academy for.
You're right, but the problem is when you start talking about other departments, and I've been having this, we'll call it a discussion recently, about having to support other departments. So as far as a county agency, which we are, we have lots of departments that are not 24 hours and we have to support them. Right. And I absolutely 100% get that. But the expectation of what we're able to do and expected to do for them is challenging because they expect us to do whatever they want us to do, but yet we're the ones supporting them. And, you know, nothing against our animal control. They have their own policies for a reason, but getting them out after hours is like pulling teeth. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has a sick raccoon in their yard, they can't go outside or they don't feel like they can go outside because they're worried they're going to get bit. In fact, I think we just had one the other day where a lady got bit by a raccoon.
Yeah.
And this isn't even Florida, Donna. Go figure. they don't come out unless it's inside the dwelling. They're like, yeah, okay, sorry. And now we can't come out and help. So we actually wound up having to change our policy that says our officers, our deputies can go out and shoot the raccoon and euthanize it.
I know we talked about this on a previous episode, but like a couple months ago, some lady called and she was upset that her fridge was making a weird noise. Why would you call the police department for that? But again, it's a liability thing. So we have to send an officer out there to make sure that nothing else weird is going on. And now we're turning into the appliance technician because we're trying to figure out what's wrong with her fridge.
Right.
The expectations are way up here, but the actual, you know, reality of what they're trained to do and can handle is
right
far below that.
Well, as I said, we have to take a look, opinion, Donna's opinion, as a society, how did we get to where we are? And it's not just a law enforcement issue. And I had a lady say, well, it's not my issue. Well, maybe not you individually, but you're part of society. And we need to sit down. You know, you want to talk about systemic racism or defunding the police or whatever. We need to look at everything.
Right.
And again, we need to have these conversations. How did we get here? What can we do to undo that?
Right.
Which you laugh about Florida. We actually have a female deputy here with our sheriff's department who has the animal wrangling background, and oh my god, they're posting all the time. She's out getting snakes, and we're talking about the big, this fat round, pythons, and this that people just let go, you know, and it shows up in somebody's yard. Well, I'm calling somebody, you know.
That's a danger. I mean, a snake that big is gonna eat a kid, you're not talking about a raccoon, right? And I shit you not, yesterday I had a call. Donna, that we had to dispatch. I actually had to call Kaylee's agency, because there was apparently we took a report earlier in the day for a stolen duck. Okay, there's a stolen duck.
This lady, that sounds like Florida.
Somebody came in the yard and stole their duck. Well, later somebody was seen feeding a similar duck in a parking lot of a grocery store. They had a cup of water, so we got called by the lady who is now at work, so she couldn't go over and check it. It's a white duck with a pink bill. Normally the bill is orange. This one has a pink bill, so that's how you can recognize it.
Okay, I was going to ask that.
No, I'm just kidding. He didn't answer anything. But we had to send somebody over there to check to see if this duck was in the parking lot and recover it. Well, he was GOA, so, you know, no duck. Duck didn't get returned. But, like, really? We took a report for a stolen duck? How do you enter that into the system? Is he serialized? I don't understand. I know there's a...
But you know, I had this conversation, this was years ago. I had a good street officer. And all of a sudden she started getting internal affairs complaints for rudeness, one after the other.
Mm-hmm.
And she finally came to me and she's like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm doing everything that I normally do. And we got to everything was, all the complaints were coming when she was working traffic crashes, every single one. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, tell me what you do when you get there. And I sat back and it was so robotic because they work so many of them. I get there, I get out, I check to see everybody's okay. Okay. I need your license, registration, blah, blah, blah. And it was just monotone, robotic. And I'm like, okay. I said, you seem to have forgotten that for one or both of these people, it could be their one and only contact with law enforcement. Their $500 damage to their car is traumatic. You know, it could be a 16-year-old who's had their first crash and, oh my God, what am I gonna? And they're looking at me and going, you're right. I've lost that part of me because I work so many of them. It's just become routine. This is my routine situation. And they've lost that part of, you're right. It's an individual incident. You know, how is it affecting that person? And I think sometimes, you know, when you think, you know, the refrigerator is kind of far-fetched, but, you know, is it bothering them so much that they're about to take a shotgun to it or something, you know?
Right, exactly.
You know,
I think in Kaylee's defense, I know we have leeway. I mean, the reality is if we think somebody's having some sort of emotional crisis because of the
refrigerator
going to turn into something, we have that instinct, then okay, we could send them. But we also have the ability to have a conversation with them. And if we can say, well, this is what you need to do, I don't have to send a deputy out on it. So we have that leeway. Some agencies don't.
These don't.
They need to have that leeway. You're the one on the phone with that person. Some bullshit policy, sorry, but some bullshit policy that's put in place that says you have to send somebody on everything when they call in on 911 or on whatever is crazy. Because I understand there's a liability, but it's a refrigerator. And based on the information you have, it's not an emergency. It doesn't require police. It requires, you know, the appliance guy down the street, and everybody can be happy and move on. But when your hands are tied and you're told you have to send somebody, okay, you're just
wasting. Well, and we have a policy. It's sort of weird because our policy is that we cannot deny anyone police services. If they're requesting police services, we have to send someone. So there are occasions where we will try to redirect a person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we'll say, like, there's, you know, I can send an officer to you, but there's really not much they can do for you.
Right.
And they're like, well, I want to speak to an officer. It's like, okay. Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, I think that's changed is it used to be like when I wore the uniform itself garnered respect.
Yes.
And that's not the case anymore.
No.
Now, the respect has to be earned. And I just had this conversation with my old department's deputy chief, as a matter of fact. Our county had a mandatory mask mandate for almost a year with COVID. And it was rescinded a couple of months ago. But some of the businesses here still have on their door, you know, we're still requiring masks. Okay. I know everybody's tired of wearing them, but I went to a locally owned business and they had their sign on the door, we're still requiring masks. But I put my mask on and I went in, and every employee and every customer had a mask on except one. And I look over and it happens to be a police officer who's readily identifiable by the polo shirt he's wearing that says police, what agency. I knew this person. They happened to be a supervisor as well. So I just kind of stood off to the side and I watched. And the people that walked by this person, they either rolled their eyes or shook their head, you know, and I'm just standing there, I'm going, really? You know, I'm like, do you know how much respect you just lost? Not right. Just for yourself.
But not just for you, right.
Yeah. For the agency.
Yeah, for the entire law enforcement community.
Community, exactly. And I'm like, so I had this conversation with the deputy chief and I said, that's just totally disrespectful. And if you don't want to wear a mask, then go find another business.
Right.
You know, or certainly don't do it when you're identifiable as a law enforcement officer. I mean,
right.
And they told me you would be surprised how many complaints we've gotten about stuff like that. I'm like,
that's too bad.
So if you want respect, you got to earn it. And right. That's not, you know, so I think we can do better on both sides.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. And like I said, there's always room for improvement in any of our professions. So
right.
We just got to be willing to be open-minded and have those discussions.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Donna. I think we're a little over an hour, probably about an hour and 10 minutes or whatever. We appreciate your time so much. I haven't read a ton of the book, but I will keep reading because it's fascinating and very moving to me. But I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you today.
I did too.
Yes.
Can we have a morning coffee club every now?
Yeah.
Hey, there we go. I like that idea.
I'll get up.
Yeah.
You won't get me up for many things, but I'll get up for that.
Yeah. No, I totally appreciate you guys having me on. Obviously, I apologize that any chance I get to talk about the people behind the badge, I'm there. And that's like I said, that certainly includes you guys, and I appreciate what you do for a living.
It's Behind and Beyond a Badge. There's two installments now, and we're hopefully working on a third. I was saying the one story that resonated with me the most was, and I don't know really why, but the one, I think it was Betty Green, the mother of one of the officers that was killed.
Right.
I didn't realize how important that story was, you know, until I read it. And I don't want to say I didn't realize how important it was, because it's obviously very important, but it's not a perspective that you often think about. So I like that was included in here, because again, you don't hear about that very often. So where can we buy your book? Do you have a website, Amazon, or what?
Both books, and yes, they're volume one and volume two. They're standalone. You don't have to have read volume one first. You can choose either. They're available on Amazon. Volume one is available paperback, hardcover, ebook. Volume two, same, except it's also available audio.
Nice.
I do have a website.
Are you reading it?
Pardon?
Are you reading it?
No, I wish I could have. I may look into that down the road, but for this one, no.
Okay.
I do have a website. It's behindandbeyondthebadge.com. There are links there that you can order the book. And really any bookstore, if you have a favorite local bookstore, they can look it up. They can order it for you. I'm on, and there's links to my social media there, but I'm on Facebook, Behind and Beyond the Badge, Instagram, Behind and Beyond the Badge, Twitter, under Donna B, 213. I'm really not a fan of social media, but to do this, I really had to step up my game with it. I love your guys' posts. I love whoever's doing your social media. I love it.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. But and my email, if they want to reach out, they can do that through the website.
Okay. Sounds good. I'm going to be talking to you more about your book. One of my long-term goals when I started Humanizing the Headset was to also do a book, much for the same reason, but just for dispatchers. Excellent. So I actually started a questionnaire like you did. So I want to pick your brain about some of that stuff in the near future. Absolutely. But thank you again so much for joining us today. We'll definitely have you back out in the future to talk more about this. Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, guys.
Yes. Thank you, Donna.
Take good care.